As that relationship began to disintegrate, Josh began calling Hope. She tried to offer as much support as she could, but in the end, Josh's divorce from Denise ended up being even more acrimonious than his divorce from Hope. The stress of the divorces had taken a heavy toll on Josh, and he no longer resembled the man she'd married. He'd put on weight, and his skin was pallid and spotted. He'd lost much of his hair, and his once athletic posture had become stooped. One time, after she hadn't seen him for a few months, it had taken Hope a few seconds to recognize him when he waved at her from across the dining room at their country club. She no longer found him attractive. In more ways than one, she felt sorry for him. Not long before he'd retired, he'd shown up at her door in a sports jacket and pressed slacks. His freshly showered appearance had signaled that it wasn't a normal visit, and she'd motioned him toward the couch. She made sure to sit at the opposite corner. It took a while for him to get to the point. He started with small talk, discussing the children and then a bit about his work. He asked whether she was still doing the New York Times crossword puzzles, a habit she'd picked up shortly after the kids started school that had slowly but surely become a minor addiction. She told him that she'd finished one just a few hours ago, and when he brought his hands together, she asked him what was on his mind.
"I was thinking the other day that you're the only real friend I have anymore," he finally said. "I have partners at work, but I can't really talk to any of them the way I do with you."
She said nothing, waiting.
"We're friends, right?"
"Yes," she said. "I suppose we are."
"We've been through a lot, haven't we?"
She nodded. "Yes."
"I've been thinking about that a lot lately. About you and me, the past, how long we've known each other. Did you realize it's been 30 years since we met?"
"I can't say that I've thought about it much."
"Yeah. Okay."
Though he nodded, she knew he'd wanted a different answer.
"I guess what I'm trying to say is that I know I made a lot of mistakes when it came to us. I'm sorry about the things I did. I don't know what was going through my mind at the time."
"You've already apologized," she said. "Besides, that's all in the past. We divorced a long time ago."
"But we were happy, right? When we were married."
"Sometimes," she admitted. "Not always." He nodded again, a hint of supplication in it.
"Do you think we could ever try again? Give it another shot?"
She wasn't sure she'd heard him right.
"You mean marriage?"
He raised his hands.
"No, not marriage. Like, going on a date. As in, can I take you to dinner on Saturday night? Just to see how it goes. It might not go anywhere, but like I said, you're my closest friend these days. I don't think that's a good idea," she said, cutting him off.
"Why not?"
"I think you're probably in a low spot right now," she said. "And when you're feeling low, sometimes even bad ideas can seem like good ones. It's important for the kids to know that we still get along, and I wouldn't want to jeopardize that."
"I don't want to jeopardize it either. I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to give us another chance. Give me a chance." In that moment, she wondered how well she'd ever known him.
"I can't," she finally said.
"Why not?"
"Because," she told him, "I'm in love with someone else."
As she walked the beach, the damp, cold air began to make her lungs ache, and she decided to turn around. At the sight of the cottage in the distance, a memory of Scotty flashed through her mind. Had he been with her, she knew he would have been disappointed and stared at her with those sweet, sad eyes of his. The kids had little memory of Scotty. Though he'd been part of the household when they were young, Hope had read once that the part of the brain that processes long-term memory isn't fully developed until a child is 7 or so, and Scotty had passed away by then. Instead, they remembered Junior, the Scottish terrier who was part of their lives until both Jacob and Rachel were in college. While Hope had doted upon Junior, she secretly admitted that Scotty would always be her favorite. For the second time on the walk, she felt her phone vibrate. While Jacob hadn't yet responded, Rachel had texted back, telling Hope to have fun. Any cute guys? Love you. With a smiley face. Hope knew that kids these days had their own texting protocols, complete with brief responses, acronyms, incorrect spelling and grammar, and a heavy use of emojis. Hope still preferred the old-fashioned way of communicating, either in person, on the phone, or in a letter. But her kids were of a different generation, and she'd learned to do what was easiest for them. She wondered what they would think if they knew the real reason she'd come to Carolina Beach. She often had the sense that her kids couldn't imagine her wanting more from life than doing crosswords, occasionally visiting the salon, and waiting around for them to visit. But then, Hope recognized that they had never known the real her, the woman she'd been at Sunset Beach so long ago. Her relationship with Rachel was different than it was with Jacob. Jacob, she thought, had more in common with his father. The two of them could spend an entire Saturday watching football. They went fishing together, enjoyed action movies and target shooting, and could talk about the stock market and investing for hours. With Hope, Jacob mainly spoke about his girlfriend and often seemed at a loss for words after that. She was closer with Rachel, particularly since her heart surgery as a teen. Although the cardiologist who oversaw Rachel's case had assured them that repairing her complicated defect was a reasonably safe procedure, Rachel had been terrified. Hope had been equally fearful, but she'd done her best to exude confidence with her daughter. In the days leading up to the operation, Rachel cried often at the thought of dying, and even more bitterly at the idea of having a disfiguring scar on her chest if she did survive. Consumed with anxiety, she babbled as if in a confessional. She told Hope that her boyfriend of 3 months had begun to pressure Rachel for sex, and that she was probably going to say yes, even though she didn't want to. She admitted that she worried constantly about her weight, and that she'd been binging and purging for several months. She said she worried all the time about almost everything. Her looks, popularity, grades, and whether she'd get accepted to the college she wanted to attend, even though the decision was years away. She picked at her cuticles incessantly, ripping at them until they bled. Occasionally, she confided, she even thought about suicide. While Hope had known that teens were adept at keeping secrets from their parents, what she heard in the days both prior to and after the surgery alarmed her deeply. After Rachel was released from the hospital, Hope found her a good therapist, and eventually a psychiatrist who prescribed antidepressants. And slowly but surely, Rachel began to feel more at ease with herself, her acute anxiety and depression finally subsiding. But those terrible days had also been the start of a new stage in their relationship, one in which Rachel learned she could be honest with her mom without feeling judged, without worrying that Hope would overreact. By the time Rachel went off to college, she seemed to feel as though she could tell her mom almost anything. Though grateful for the honesty, Hope admitted there were some subjects, mainly concerning the quantity of alcohol that college students seemed to drink every weekend, where a little less honesty would have meant less anxiety on Hope's part. Perhaps their intimacy was the reason for Rachel's text. Like any loyal girlfriend, Rachel reflected her concern for Hope's relationship status by asking about cute guys. "Have you ever thought about maybe meeting someone?" Rachel had asked her a little over a year ago. "Not really." "Why not? Is it because no one has asked you out?" "I've been asked out by a few different men. I just told them no." "Because they were jerks?" "Not at all. Most of them seemed very kind." Rachel had frowned at that. "Then what is it? Is it because you were afraid? Because of what happened between Dad and Denise?" "I had the two of you and my work, and I was content with that." "But you're retired. We don't live at home anymore. And I don't like the thought of you always being alone. I mean, what if the perfect man is out there just waiting for you?" Hope's smile bore a trace of melancholy. "Then I suppose I'll have to try to find him, won't I?" As terrifying as Rachel's heart surgery had been for Hope, the slow-motion death of her father had in some ways been even more difficult to endure. The first few years after Sunset Beach hadn't been so bad. Her father could still move around, and with every passing month, Hope could remember growing more firm in her conviction that he'd contracted a slower-progressing version of ALS. There were periods when he even seemed to improve. But then, in the course of 6 or 7 weeks, it was as though a switch had suddenly been thrown. Walking became difficult for her father, then unsteady without support, and then altogether impossible. Along with her sisters, Hope chipped in to help as much as possible. They installed hand railings in the bathtub and hallways, and found a used van for disabled people with a wheelchair lift. They hoped it would enable their father to get around town, but his ability to drive lasted less than 7 months, and their mother was too nervous to drive the van at all. They sold it at a loss, and in the last year of his life, her father never ventured farther than either the front porch or back deck, unless he was going to see his doctors. But he wasn't alone, because he was loved by his family and revered by former students and co-workers. Visitors flocked to the house. As was customary in the South, they brought food, and at the end of every week, Hope's mother would plead with her daughters to take some of it home with them, because the refrigerator was overstuffed. Even that relatively uplifting period was short-lived, however, ending for good when her father began losing the ability to speak. In the final few months of his life, he was hooked to an oxygen tank and suffered from violent coughing fits because his muscles were too weak to dislodge the phlegm. Hope could remember the countless times she pounded on his back while her father struggled to breathe. He'd lost so much weight that she sometimes felt as though she would break him in half, but eventually her dad would cough up the phlegm and take long, gasping breaths in the aftermath, his face as pale as rice. The final week seemed like a single extended fever dream. Home health nurses were hired, at first for half the day, and then around the clock. Her dad had to be fed liquid through straws. He became so weak that finishing even half a glass took nearly an hour. Incontinence followed as his body rapidly wasted away. Hope visited him every day during that period. Because speaking had become a challenge for him, she did all the talking. She would tell him about the kids or confide her struggles with Josh. She confessed that a neighbor had seen Josh at a hotel with a local realtor. She confirmed that Josh had recently admitted the affair, but was still in communication with a woman, and Hope wasn't sure what to do. Finally, during one of his last lucid periods, 6 years after her stay at Sunset Beach, Hope told her father about True. As she spoke, he maintained eye contact, and when she reached the part of the story where she'd broken down in front of her father on the porch, he moved his hand for the first time in weeks. She reached over, taking it in hers. He breathed out, long and hard, sounds coming from the back of his throat. They were unintelligible, but she knew him well enough to understand what he was saying. "Are you sure it's not too late?" 6 days later, he passed away. Hundreds of people attended the funeral, and afterward, everyone made their way to the house. When they left later that evening, the house went quiet, as though it had died as well. Hope knew that people reacted to stress and grief in different ways, but she found herself shocked by her mom's downward spiral, which was furious in its intensity and seemingly unstoppable. Her mom fell into bitter fits of unpredictable weeping and started drinking heavily. She stopped tidying up and left dirty clothes strewn about the floors. Dust coated the shelves, and dishes would sit on the counters until Hope came by to clean. Food spoiled in the refrigerator, and the television blared nonstop. Then her mom began to complain of various ailments, sensitivity to light, aching joints, waves of pain in her stomach, and difficulty swallowing. Whenever Hope went to visit, she found her fidgety and often unable to complete her thoughts. Other times she would retreat to her darkened bedroom and lock the door. The silence behind the door
was often more unnerving than her fits of weeping. The passage of time made things worse, not better. Her mom eventually became as housebound as her dad once had been. She left the house only to go to the doctor's office, and 4 years after her husband's funeral, she was scheduled for a hernia operation. The surgery was considered a minor one, and by all accounts, it went well. The hernia was repaired, and her mother's vitals had remained stable throughout the procedure. In post-op, however, her mother never woke from the anesthesia. She died 2 days later. Hope knew the physician, the anesthesiologist, and the nurses. All had taken part in other operations that same day, both before and after Hope's mother's, with no other patient suffering adverse consequences. Hope had spent enough time in the medical world to know that bad things sometimes happened, and there wasn't always an easy explanation. Part of her wondered whether her mom had simply wanted to die, and somehow succeeded. The following week passed in a blur. Dazed, she remembered little about the wake or the funeral. In the weeks that followed, neither she nor her sisters had the emotional reserves necessary to start going through their mother's belongings. Instead, Hope would sometimes wander the home where she'd grown up, unable to grasp the idea of living without parents. Even though she was an adult, it would take years for her to stop thinking she could pick up the phone and call either one of them. The loss and melancholy faded slowly, eventually displaced by fonder memories. She would recall the vacations they'd taken as a family and the walks she'd enjoyed with her father. She remembered dinners and birthday parties and cross-country meets and school projects with her mom. Her favorite memories were of her parents as a couple, recalling the way they used to flirt when they thought the kids weren't looking. But the smile would often fade as quickly as it had come, for it would make her think of True as well, and the opportunity she'd lost for the two of them to make a life together. Back at the cottage, Hope took a few minutes to warm her hands over one of the burners on the stove. Way too cold for October, she thought. Knowing the temperature would drop further as soon as the sun went down, she considered using the fireplace, gas lines with gas logs, so a flip of a switch was all it took to light it, but decided instead to raise the thermostat and make herself a cup of hot chocolate. As a child, she'd liked nothing better when she was chilled, but she'd stopped drinking it around the time she became a teenager. Too many calories, she'd worried back then. These days, she no longer cared about such things. It reminded her of her age, something she'd rather not think about. Fair or not, they lived in a society that placed an emphasis on youth and beauty when it came to women. She liked to think she didn't look her age, but also admitted that she might be fooling herself. She supposed it really didn't matter. She'd come to the beach for more important reasons. Sipping her hot chocolate, she watched the play of fading sunlight on the water as she reflected on the last 24 years. Had Josh ever sensed that she had feelings for another man? As hard as she'd tried to hide it, she wondered whether her secret love for another had in some way undermined her marriage. Had Josh ever intuited that when they were in bed together, Hope sometimes fantasized about True? Had he sensed that part of her would always be closed off to him? She didn't want to think so, but could it have been a factor in his numerous affairs? Not that she was willing to take all the blame, or even most of it, for what he'd done. Josh was an adult, and fully in control of his behaviors. But what if? The questions had plagued her ever since she'd learned of his first affair. She'd known all along she hadn't committed fully to him, just as she now knew that the marriage had been doomed from the instant she'd accepted his proposal. She tried to make up for it with friendship these days, even if she had no desire to rekindle anything between them. In her mind, it was a way to make amends, or atone, even if Josh might never really understand. She would never confess her guilt to him. She never wanted to hurt anyone again, ever. But no confession meant no chance at forgiveness. She accepted that, just as she accepted the guilt for other wrongs she'd committed in her life. In quiet times, she'd tell herself that most of them would be considered minor when compared to the secret she'd kept from her husband. But there was one that continued to haunt her. It was the reason she'd come to the beach, and the mirror image of the two great wrongs in her life struck her as both ironic and profound. To Josh, she'd said nothing about True in the hope of sparing his feelings. To True, she'd told the truth about Josh, even while knowing the words would break his heart. The Box. Hope woke to the sight of a sky the color of robin's eggs, peeking through gauzy white curtains. Glancing out the window, she saw that the sun made the beach glow almost white. It was going to be a gorgeous day, except for the temperature. A cold front pushing down from the Ohio Valley was expected to last for a few more days, with gusty winds that would likely steal her breath as she walked the beach. In the past few years, she had begun to understand why Florida and Arizona were such popular retirement destinations. Stretching her stiff legs, she got up and started some coffee, then showered and dressed. Though she wasn't hungry, she fried an egg for breakfast and forced herself to eat it. Then, putting on her jacket and gloves, she stepped onto the back porch with her second cup of coffee, watching the world slowly come to life. There were few people on the beach, a man trailing behind a dog in the same way she used to follow Scotty, and a female jogger in the distance who'd left a trail of footprints near the water's edge. The woman had a bouncy stride that kept her ponytail swinging to a lively beat, and as Hope watched, she remembered how much she used to enjoy running. She'd given up the sport when the kids were young, and for whatever reason, never resumed. She thought now that it had been a mistake. Nowadays, her physical condition was a source of constant preoccupation. Sometimes she longed for the heedless way in which she once took her body for granted. Age revealed so many things about oneself, she mused. She took a sip of coffee, wondering how the day would unfold. She already felt on edge, even as she cautioned herself against getting her hopes up. Last year, when she'd come to the beach, she'd been buoyed by the excitement of her plan, despite its unlikely odds of success. But last year had been the beginning, and today it would end, answering once and for all the question of whether miracles really could happen. When Hope finished her coffee, she went inside and checked the clock. It was time for her to get started. On the counter was a radio, and she turned it on. Music was always part of the ritual, and she adjusted the dial until she found a station playing soft acoustics. She increased the volume, remembering that she and True had been listening to the radio on the night they'd first made love. In the refrigerator, she found the bottle of wine she'd opened the night before and poured herself a small glass, not much more than a swallow. Like the music, wine was part of the ritual she followed whenever opening the box. But because she had to drive, she doubted she would even finish what she'd poured. She carried the glass to the table and took a seat. The box was where she'd left it the day before. Setting the glass aside, she pulled the box toward her. It was surprisingly heavy. It was constructed of dense wood, both chocolate and caramel-colored, and had oversized brass hinges. As usual, she took time to admire the intricate carvings on the lid and around the sides, imaginative stylized elephants and lions, zebras and rhinos, giraffes and cheetahs. She'd spotted the box in a booth at a Raleigh street fair, and when she learned that it had been made in Zimbabwe, she knew she had to buy it. Josh, however, had been less than impressed. "Why on earth would you buy something like that?" he'd said with a snort. At the time, he'd been eating a hot dog while Jacob and Rachel played in a bouncy house. "And where are you going to put it?" "I haven't decided yet," she'd answered. Once home, she brought the box to the master bedroom, where she stored it under her bed until he went to work on Monday. Then, after adding the contents to it, she'd hidden it at the bottom of a box of baby clothes in the attic, a place she knew Josh would never find it. Since their time at Sunset Beach, True had never tried to contact her. For the first year or two, she'd worried that she might find a letter in the mailbox or hear his voice on the answering machine. When the phone rang in the evenings, she sometimes tensed, steeling herself just in case. Strangely, her relief that it wasn't him was always coupled with a wave of disappointment. However, he'd written that there was no room for three people in the life she would be leading, and as painful as it was, she knew that he'd been right. Even at the lowest points in her marriage to Josh, she hadn't tried to contact True either. She'd thought about it, come close a few times, but had never succumbed to the temptation. It would have been easy to run to him, but then what? She couldn't face the thought of having to say goodbye a second time, nor was she willing to risk the destruction of her family. Despite Josh's failings, her children remained her priority, and they needed her undivided attention. So she'd kept him alive in her memories, in the only way she could. She stored her keepsakes in the box and examined the contents every now and then, when she knew she wouldn't be disturbed. Whenever there was a television show about the majestic game animals in Africa, she would make a point of tuning in. In the late 1990s, she stumbled upon the novels of Alexander McCall Smith and was immediately hooked, since many of the stories were set in Botswana. It wasn't Zimbabwe, but it was close enough, she thought, and it helped further introduce her to a world she knew nothing about. Over the years, there were also occasional articles about Zimbabwe in major news magazines and the Raleigh News and Observer. She learned about the land confiscation by the government and wondered what had happened to the farm where True had been raised. She also read about the country's hyperinflation, and her first thought was of how it might affect tourism and whether True would be able to continue guiding. Occasionally, she would receive travel catalogs in the mail, and she would turn to the section that described various safaris. Though most of the safaris were in South Africa, every now and then, she'd read about the lodge at Hwange. When that happened, she would study the photographs, trying to get a better sense of the world he called home. And as she lay in bed afterward, she would admit to herself that her feelings for him were as real and strong as they had been so long ago, when she'd first whispered that she loved him. In 2006, when her divorce was finalized, True would have been 58 years old. She was 52. Jacob and Rachel were teenagers, and Josh was already seeing Denise. Though 16 years had passed since she'd seen True, she'd hoped that there was still time to make things right. By then, practically anything could be found on the internet, but the information about the lodges at Hwange didn't include anything about the guides, other than to note that they were among the most experienced in Zimbabwe. There was, however, an email address, and the woman who answered her query had told Hope that she didn't know True and that he hadn't worked at the lodge in years. The same went for Romy, the friend True had mentioned to her. Nonetheless, the woman gave Hope the name of the previous manager who had transferred to another camp a few years earlier, along with another email address. Hope contacted him there, and while he knew nothing of True's whereabouts, he offered the name of yet another camp manager who'd worked at Hwange in the 1990s. There was no current phone number or email address, but he gave Hope a mailing address with a caveat that it might not be up to date either. Hope wrote to the manager and waited anxiously for a response. True had warned her that time moves more slowly in the bush, and that the mail service wasn't always reliable. Weeks passed without a response, then months, by which point Hope had given up thinking she'd ever hear from him. It was around that time that a letter had appeared in her mailbox. The kids had yet to come home from school, and she tore open the letter, devouring the scrawled words. She learned that True had left Hwange, but the manager had heard through the grapevine that he may have taken another job in Botswana. He was unsure at which camp, however. The man added that he was also fairly certain that True had sold the house in Bulawayo once his son headed off to a university somewhere in Europe. He didn't know the name of the university or even the country where it was located. With little to go on, Hope began contacting lodges in Botswana. There were dozens of them. She sent email after email, but found no information about True. She didn't bother trying to contact universities in Europe, since that was akin to trying to find a needle in a haystack. Running thin on options, Hope reached out to Air Zimbabwe, hoping to find someone who worked there who had a wife named Kim. Perhaps, through his ex, Hope might learn where True was. That, too, led to a dead end. A man named Ken had worked there until 2001 or 2002, but he'd left the company, and no one had heard from him since. After that, Hope tried a more general approach. She contacted various government agencies in Zimbabwe, asking about a massive farm owned by a family named Walls. She'd held this option until last, suspecting that True had reduced contact with the family even further after learning what he had from his biological father. The officials there were less than helpful, but by the end of the conversations, she surmised that the farm had been confiscated by the government and redistributed to tribal citizens of the country. There was no information at all on the family. Out of ideas, Hope decided to make it easier for True to find her on the off chance he was looking. In 2009, she had joined Facebook, and she checked it daily for a long time. She heard from old friends and new ones, family members, people she'd known from work. But never once did True try to contact her. The realization that True had seemingly vanished and that they would never see each other again had put her in a funk for months and made her reflect on all the other losses in her life. But this was a different kind of grief, one that grew stronger with every passing year. Now, with her children grown, she spent her days and nights alone. Life was passing, and all too soon would come to an end. Despite herself, Hope began to wonder if she'd be alone when she took her final breaths. Her house, she sometimes felt, was slowly but surely becoming her tomb. At the cottage, Hope took a small sip of wine. Though it was light and sweet, it tasted foreign in the morning. Never once in her life had she drunk wine this early, and she doubted she ever would again. But today, she thought she deserved it. As transporting as the memories were, as much as they'd sustained her, she was tired of feeling trapped by them. She wanted to spend her remaining years waking in the morning, without wondering whether True would somehow find her again. She wanted to spend as much time with Jacob and Rachel as she could. She longed more than anything for peace of mind. She wanted a month to pass without feeling the need to examine the contents of the box that sat on the table in front of her. She wanted to focus instead on crossing a few of the big items off her bucket list. Sit in the audience of the Ellen DeGeneres show. Visit the Biltmore Estate at Christmas. Bet on a horse running at the Kentucky Derby. Watch UNC and Duke play basketball at Cameron Indoor Stadium. That last one would be tough. Tickets were nearly impossible to get. But the challenge of that was part of the fun, right? Not long after her trip to the beach last year, on a day she'd been feeling particularly blue, she deleted her Facebook page. Since then, she'd also left the box in the attic, no matter how strongly she'd felt the pull to examine the contents. Now, however, the box was calling to her, and she finally lifted the lid. On top was Ellen's faded wedding invitation. She stared at the lettering, remembering who she'd been back then, and recalling the worries that had plagued her when she first arrived at the beach that week. Sometimes she wished she could speak with the woman she used to be, but she wasn't sure what she would have said. She supposed that she could assure the younger version of herself that she'd have children, but would she add that raising them wasn't anything like the ideal she'd envisioned? That as much as she treasured them, there were countless times when they enraged or disappointed her. That her worries about them were sometimes overwhelming. Or would she tell the younger version of herself that, after having children, there would be times when she wished she could be truly free again? And what could she possibly say about Josh? She supposed it didn't matter now, nor was it worth the time it took to even dwell on the questions. But the invitation nonetheless made her reflect that life resembled an infinite number of dominoes set up to topple on the world's largest floor,
where one domino leads inevitably to the next. Had the invitation not arrived, Hope may never have argued with Josh, or spent the week without him at Sunset Beach, or even met True in the first place. The invitation, she speculated, was the domino that, when toppled, set in motion the rest of her life. The choreography that had led to the most profound experience of love she'd ever had struck her as both scripted and improbable, but she wondered again to what end. Setting the invitation aside, Hope reached for the first of the drawings. True had drawn her the morning after they'd made love, and Hope knew that she no longer resembled the woman in the drawing. In the sketch, her skin was soft and unlined, glowing with the last breath of youth. Her thick hair was shot with sunlit highlights. Her breasts were firm and high, her legs toned and unblemished. He'd captured her in a way that no photograph ever had, and as she continued to study it, she mused that she'd never looked prettier, because he'd drawn her the way he saw her. Placing it on top of the wedding invitation, she reached for the second drawing. He'd completed it while she'd been at the wedding, and over the years, whenever she went through the contents of the box, she always lingered over this sketch. In it, the two of them stood on the beach, near the water's edge. The pier was in the background, and sunlight glinted off the ocean as they stared at each other in profile. Her arms were around his neck, and his hands were at her waist. Again, she thought he'd made her more beautiful than she really was, but it was the image of him that captured her. She studied the lines at the corners of his eyes and the dimple in his chin. She traced the shape of his shoulders beneath the loose fabric of his shirt. Most of all, though, she marveled at the expression he'd given himself as he stared at her. That of a man deeply in love with a woman he held in his arms. She pulled the drawing closer, wondering whether he had ever again looked at another woman this way. She would never know, and though there was part of her that wished him happiness, another part wanted to believe that the feelings they'd had for each other were entirely unique. She set that drawing aside as well. Next came the letter that True had written to her, the one she'd found in the glove compartment. The paper had yellowed at the edges, and there were small tears in the creases. The letter had become as brittle as she had. The realization brought a lump to her throat as she traced a line between her name at the top and his at the bottom, connecting them once more. She read the words she already knew by heart, never tiring of their power. Rising from the table, Hope moved to the kitchen window. As her mind wandered, she realized that she could see True walking past the cottage with a fishing pole draped over his shoulder, a tackle box in his other hand, and she watched as he turned to face her. He waved, and in response, she reached out, touching the glass. "I never stopped loving you," she whispered, but the glass was cold, and the kitchen was quiet. And when she blinked, she realized that the beach was entirely deserted. 20 minutes to go, one item left. It was a photocopy of a letter she'd written last year. She had placed the original in Kindred Spirit on her previous trip to the beach, and as she unfolded the copy, she told herself how silly her gesture had been. A letter means nothing if the intended recipient never receives it, and True would never learn of it. Yet in the letter, she'd made a promise to herself, one that she intended to keep. If nothing else, she hoped it would give her the strength she needed to finally say goodbye. "This is a letter to God and the universe. I need your help in what I imagine will be my last attempt to apologize for a decision I made so long ago. My story is both straightforward and complicated. To capture accurately all that happened would require a book, so instead, I will offer only the basics. In September of 1990, while visiting Sunset Beach, I met a man from Zimbabwe named True Walls. At the time, he worked as a safari guide at a camp in the Hwange Reserve. He also had a home in Bulawayo, but he'd grown up on a farm near Harare. He was 42, divorced, and had a 10-year-old son named Andrew. We met on a Wednesday morning,
and I'd fallen in love with him by Thursday evening. You may think this impossible, that perhaps I'm confusing infatuation with love. All I can say is that I've considered those possibilities 1,000 times and rejected them. If you met him, you would understand why he captured my heart. If you had seen the two of us together, you would know that the feelings we had for each other were undeniably real. In the short period we were together, I like to think that we became soulmates, forever intertwined. By Sunday, however, it was over, and I was the one who ended it, for reasons I have agonized over for decades. It was the right decision at the time. It was also the wrong decision. I would do the same thing again. I would have done it all differently. This confusion remains with me even now, but I have learned to accept that I will never rid myself of the questions. Needless to say, my decision crushed him. My guilt over this continues to haunt me. I have now reached a point in life where making amends whenever possible feels important, and this is where God and the universe can help, for my plea is a simple one. I would like to see True again, so that I can apologize to him. I want his forgiveness, if something like that is even possible. In my dreams, I'm hopeful that this will give me peace of mind. I need him to understand how much I loved him then, and still love him now, and I want him to know how sorry I am. Perhaps you are wondering why I did not try to contact him through more conventional means. I did. I tried for years to find him without luck, nor do I really believe this letter will reach him. But if it does, then I will ask if he remembers the place that we visited together on Thursday afternoon, right before it began to rain. This is where I'll be on October 16, 2014. If he remembers the place with the same reverence I do, then he'll also know what time of day I'll be there. Hope. Eyeing the clock, Hope knew that Kindred Spirit was waiting. She put the items back in the box and closed the lid with finality, already knowing that she wouldn't return the box to the attic, nor would she bring the contents home. The box itself would be left here at the cottage, on the mantel, and the owner could do with it whatever he wanted. Aside from the wedding invitation, the rest of the contents would be left at Kindred Spirit later in the week. She needed a day or two to erase their identities, but she hoped that other visitors would revel in the items, as she and True had once treasured Joe's letter to Lena. She wanted people to know that love often lies in wait, ready to bloom when least expected. The drive was straightforward, a route she knew like the back of her hand. She crossed over the newer bridge at Sunset Beach, drove past the pier to the western edge of the island, and found a place to park. Bundling up, she trudged slowly through the low-slung dunes, relieved to see that as much as the island had changed, the beach was still the same. Storms and hurricanes, as well as currents, were continually altering the barrier islands along North Carolina's coast, but Sunset Beach appeared relatively immune, even though she'd heard last year that Bird Island could now be accessed on foot, even when it wasn't low tide. The sand was spongy, leaving her winded, and her legs felt leaden. When she reached the western edge of Sunset Beach, she glanced over her shoulder. She saw no one else walking in the same direction, only a lonely stretch of sand with gentle waves lapping along the shoreline. A brown pelican skimmed the breakers, and she watched until it became nothing but a speck in the distance. Gathering herself, she started forward again, crossing the hard-packed sand gully that had been submerged only hours before. As soon as she reached Bird Island, the wind, which had been blowing steadily, ceased, as though welcoming her home. The air itself felt thinner and filmy here, and the sun, now ascendant, made her squint as it reflected off the prism of the sea. In the sudden silence, Hope understood that she'd been lying to herself ever since she'd arrived. She wasn't making this trek to say goodbye. She'd come here because she still wanted to believe in the impossible. She'd come because part of her clung irrationally to the belief that Kindred Spirit held the key to their future. She'd come today because she longed with every cell of her body to believe that True had somehow learned about her letter and would be here, waiting. Logically, she understood how crazy it was to wish for such a thing, but she couldn't shake the feeling that True would be there. With every step, his presence seemed closer. She heard his voice in the endless roar of the ocean, and despite the chill, she felt herself growing warmer. The sand clawed at her, grabbing every step, but she increased her pace. Her breath came out in little puffs. Her heart began to race, but still she pressed onward. Terns and gulls clustered in groups, while sandpipers darted in and out of the gently lapping waves. She felt a sudden kinship with them, for she knew they would be the only witnesses to a reunion that had been 24 years in the making. They would watch as she fell into his arms. They would hear him proclaim that he'd never stopped loving her. He would spin her around and kiss her, and they would rush back to the cottage, eager to make up for lost time. A sudden gust of wind broke her from her reverie, a hard gust, enough to make her feel unsteady on her feet, and she thought, "Who am I kidding?" She was a fool, a believer in fairy tales, enthralled to memories that now kept her prisoner. There was no one standing near the water's edge or approaching in the distance. She was alone out here, and the certainty she'd felt regarding True's presence slipped away as quickly as it had come. "He won't be here," she chided herself. "He couldn't be here, because he knew nothing about the letter." Breathing hard, hope slowed, focusing her energy blindly on placing one foot in front of the other. Minutes passed. 10, then 15. By this point, she felt she was progressing by mere inches with every step. Finally, she was able to spot the American flag in the distance, furling and unfurling in the breeze, and knew it was time to start angling away from the water's edge. Just beyond the curve of the dune, she spotted the mailbox and bench, as lonely and abandoned as ever. She headed for the bench, nearly collapsing onto it as soon as she arrived. True was nowhere to be seen. The day had continued to brighten, and she shielded her eyes against the glare. Last year when she'd come, it had been cloudy, similar to the day she'd visited with True. She'd felt a sense of déjà vu, but now the high and steady sun seemed to taunt her for her foolishness. The angle of the dune blocked her view of the sandy stretch of beach she'd just traversed, so she trained her gaze in the opposite direction. The flag, the waves, shorebirds, and the gently swaying sawgrass capping the dunes. She marveled at how little the landscape had changed since her father had first brought her here, in contrast to how much had changed within her. She'd lived almost an entire life, but had accomplished nothing extraordinary. She'd made no permanent mark on the world, nor would she ever. But if love was all that really mattered, she understood that she'd been singularly blessed. She decided to rest before heading back. But first, she would check the mailbox. Her fingers tingled as she pulled it open and reached for the stack of letters. Carrying them back to the bench, she used her scarf to weight down the stack. For the next half hour, she immersed herself in reading the missives that others had left. Nearly all dealt with loss, as if in keeping with some sort of theme. Two letters were from a father and daughter, who had written to a wife and mother who had died 4 months prior of ovarian cancer. Another was written by a woman named Valentina, who was grieving the husband she'd lost. Still another described the loss of a grandchild who'd passed away from a drug overdose. A particularly well-written letter described the fears associated with the loss of a job and the eventual loss of the person's home through foreclosure. Three of them were from recent widows, and though she wished it were otherwise, all of them served as a reminder that True was gone forever, too. She set aside the pile she'd read. There were only two letters left. Thinking she might as well finish, she reached for yet another envelope. It had been opened, and she pulled the letter free, unfolding it in the sun. It was written on yellow legal paper, and she glanced at the name at the top,
unable to believe what she was seeing. Hope. She blinked, continuing to stare at her name. Hope. It couldn't be, but it was, and she felt a wave of dizziness. She recognized the handwriting. She'd seen it earlier that morning in the letter True had written long ago. She would have recognized it anywhere, but if that was the case, where was he? Why wasn't he here? Her mind continued to race, nothing making sense at all, except for the letter she held in her hand. There was a date at the top. October 2nd, which was 12 days ago. 12 days? Had he been 12 days early? She didn't understand, and her confusion led to even more questions. Had he gotten the date wrong? Had he learned of her letter, or was the whole thing a coincidence? Was the letter even for her? Had she really recognized the handwriting? And if so, where was he? Where was he? Where was he? Her hands began to shake, and she closed her eyes, trying to slow her thoughts and the cascade of questions. She drew several long, deep breaths, telling herself that she'd been imagining all of it. When she opened her eyes, there would be a different name at the top. When she really examined the letter, she would see that the handwriting didn't match at all. When she had regained a semblance of self-control, she lowered her gaze to the page. Hope. Nor, she realized, had she been mistaken about the handwriting. It was his. No one's but his. And she felt a catch in her throat as she finally began to read. Hope. The destiny that matters most in life is the one concerning love. I write those words as I sit in a room where I've been staying for more than a month. It's a bed and breakfast called the Stanley House, and it's located in the historic district of Wilmington. The owners are very kind. It's quiet most of the time, and the food is good. I know these details may feel irrelevant, but I'm nervous, so let me start with the obvious. I learned about your letter on August 23rd, and I flew to North Carolina 2 days later. I knew where you wanted to meet me, and guessed that you would visit at low tide. But for reasons I can best explain later, I didn't know the exact date you would be there. I had only vague references to work from, which is why I chose to stay at a bed and breakfast. If I was going to be in North Carolina for a while, I wanted some place more comfortable than a hotel, but I didn't want the trouble of renting a place. I wasn't even sure how to go about something like that in a foreign country, to tell you the truth. All I knew was that I had to come, since I'd promised you that I would. Despite the lack of particulars, I assumed that you'd picked a date in September. That's when we met, after all. I visited Kindred Spirit every day this past month. I watched and waited for you without success, all the while wondering whether I'd missed you, or whether you had changed your mind. I wondered if fate had conspired to keep us apart once more. When September gave way to October, I made the decision to leave you a letter, with the hope that you may one day learn of it, in the same inexplicable way I had learned of yours. You see, I also learned that you wanted to apologize for what had happened between us, for making the decision that you did so long ago. I told you then, and I still believe now, that no apology is necessary. Meeting you and falling in love with you was an experience I would relive 1,000 times in 1,000 different lives if I was ever given that chance. You are, and always have been, forgiven. True. After finishing the letter, Hope continued to stare at the page, her heart pounding in her chest. The world seemed to be closing in, collapsing from all sides. The letter offered no clues as to whether he'd stayed, no means of contacting him if he'd returned to Africa. "Did you leave?" she cried aloud. "Please don't tell me you've already left." As she spoke the words, she lifted her eyes from the page and caught sight of a man standing no more than 10 feet away. The sun cast him in shadow, making it hard to see his features.
but she had visualized his image so many thousands of times over the years that she recognized him anyway. Her mouth opened, and as he took a hesitant step toward her, she saw that he'd begun to smile.
"I didn't leave,"
True said to her.
"I'm still here."
Reunion. Staring at him, Hope felt frozen to the bench. It couldn't be happening. There was no way that True could really be here, and yet she couldn't hold back the avalanche of emotions that crashed over her. Wonder and joy were coupled with absolute shock, making it impossible for her to speak, and a tiny part of her feared that if she did, the illusion would be shattered. He was here. She could see him. She'd heard him speak, and with the sound of his voice, the memories of their time together materialized with vivid force. Her first thought was that he'd changed little in the year since she'd seen him last. He was still lean, his broad shoulders unbent by age, and while his hair had thinned and turned silver gray, it had the same careless, tousled look she'd always adored. He was dressed the same as he'd dressed back then, in a neatly tucked-in button-up shirt, jeans, and boots. She remembered him being impervious to the cold, but today he was wearing a jacket that reached his hips, though he hadn't bothered to zip it up. He hadn't moved any closer, seemingly as stunned as she. Eventually, he broke the spell.
"Hello, Hope."
Hearing him say her name made her heart slam in her chest. "True?" she breathed. He started toward her.
"I see you found the letter I left you."
Only then did she realize she was still holding it.
"I did."
She nodded. She folded it and absently slipped it into the pocket of her jacket, her mind a jumble of colliding images, past and present.
"Were you behind me on the beach? I didn't see you."
He hooked a thumb over his shoulder.
"I walked over from Sunset Beach, but I didn't see you either. Not until the mailbox came into view, anyway. I'm sorry if I startled you."
She shook her head as she rose from the bench.
"I still can't believe you're here. I feel like I'm dreaming."
"You're not dreaming."
"How do you know?"
"Because,"
he responded gently, his accent exactly as she remembered.
"Both of us can't be dreaming." "It's been a long time,"
he added.
"Yes, it has."
"You're still beautiful,"
he said, a note of wonder in his voice. She felt the blood rise in her cheeks, a sensation she'd almost forgotten.
"Hardly."
She pushed a wind-blown lock of hair out of her face.
"But thank you."
He closed the gap between them and gently took her hand in his. The warmth of his grip spread throughout her, and while he was close enough to kiss her, he didn't. Instead, he traced his thumb slowly across her skin, the feeling electric.
"How are you?"
he asked. Every cell in her body seemed to be vibrating. She brought her lips together before going on.
"Actually, I don't know how I'm doing, other than feeling shell-shocked."
His eyes captured hers, collapsing the years they'd lost.
"There's so much I want to ask you,"
he said.
"Me too,"
she whispered.
"It's so good to see you again."
As he spoke, her vision began to telescope, the wider world shrinking to the dimensions of that singular moment. True suddenly standing before her, after so many years apart. And without another word, they went together. He put his arms around her, drawing her close, and all at once she felt as if she were 36 again, dissolving in the shelter of his body as the autumn sunlight streamed down around them. They stayed like that for a long time until she finally pulled back to look at him. Really look. Though the lines had grown deeper in his face, the dimple on his chin and the color of his eyes were the same as she remembered. She found herself foolishly relieved that she'd had her hair done recently, and that she'd taken time with her appearance this morning. The clash of memory and immediate sensation was roiling her thoughts, and she felt her eyes inexplicably well with tears.
She swiped at them, embarrassed.
Are you all right?
He asked.
I'm fine, she sniffed. I'm sorry for crying, but I never really believed that you would be here.
He offered a wry smile.
I'll admit that it was a fairly extraordinary sequence of events that led me back to you.
Despite her tears, she laughed under her breath at the phrasing. He sounded like he always had, making it a bit easier to regain her bearings.
How did you find my letter? She wondered. Were you here in the last year?
No,
he said.
And I didn't actually find it, or even read it. I was told about it. But more importantly, how are you? What happened to you during all these years?
I'm fine, she answered automatically.
She trailed off, suddenly blank. What does one say to a former lover after 24 years, when she had been fantasizing about this moment ever since they'd said goodbye?
A lot happened, was all she could think to say.
Really?
He raised an eyebrow in jest, and she couldn't help but smile. They had always felt a natural ease with each other, and that, at least, remained unchanged.
I wouldn't even know where to start, she admitted.